The legal proceedings against former President Donald Trump has featured verbal attacks made by him against witnesses and jurors. On Tuesday, Trump was found in contempt and fined for his behavior, violating a gag order. Trump has a history in lashing out at those involved in legal proceedings against him, including the judges. Trump's legal team argues he's within his rights as a citizen and candidate and that his speech is protected. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. Legal experts counter that Trump's words are contributing to a decline in trust in our judicial system and undermining the safety of those sworn to uphold the law. This hour, we'll discuss the issue with two federal judges. Later, the Olympic glory of Jesse Owens and Harrison Dillard began at Cleveland's East Tech High School. Now the school is leaning into its past by restarting its track team. Those conversations are coming up. First, the news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Good morning, and thanks so much for joining us. Yesterday, former President Donald Trump was held in contempt and fined $9,000 for repeatedly violating a gag order. He was warned that he could go to jail if he continued to attack witnesses and jurors. The former president has a history of attacking those involved in his legal proceedings, including disparaging judges overseeing his criminal and civil cases. A strategy that some see as a concerted attempt to delegitimize the court system while he undergoes multiple trials at the same time as he runs for a second term as president. His legal team argues that Trump has clear rights protecting his speech as a citizen and as a presidential candidate. But legal experts say his actions are contributing to an overall growing distrust of the judicial system and undermining the safety of the people sworn to uphold the rule of law and their families. A Washington Post analysis of Trump's social media posts says he's gone after judges or their family members by name 138 times. And a Reuters analysis found that threats against federal judges as a whole have more than doubled since late 2020. To begin today's program, we'll talk to two federal judges in Ohio about Trump's actions and the broader issue of judicial safety, as well as the public perception of the court system. Joining me in person in the studio for this conversation are two judges from the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Ohio. Judge Dan Polster, thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome, Jenny. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. And Judge J. Philip Calabrese, thanks so much for being here.
Good morning.
Glad to have both of you. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 866-578-578. 0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org or tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Now, I want to note that both of you were appointed to your positions by presidents of different parties. Judge Polster, you were appointed by President Bill Clinton. Judge Calabrese, you were appointed by President Trump. But you're both here to talk about how judicial safety is not a partisan issue. I'd love to start with you, Judge Calabrese.
Well, good morning. It's good to be able to be a part of this conversation with you and your listeners. Because of the ethical rules that govern what judges can comment on in terms of pending cases and the like, I'm not going to talk about specific cases that might be pending. But what I will say is that what I have seen in the time I've been on the bench, it's not as long as my colleague here, but approaching 5 years at this point, what we see is part of a growing trend, in my view, and a growing problem across the political spectrum. There are powerful people and influential people in positions of authority who believe that delegitimizing the courts, attacking judicial independence, somehow serves their political ends. And you see the consequences of that every day. We just had, you raised the issue of judicial safety. In the last couple of years, we've had only the second attempted assassination of a sitting Supreme Court justice in our nation's history. So the threats are very real.
And Judge Polster, would you add to that?
Thank you very much. It's a privilege to be here. I echo what my colleague said. You know, there are countries around the world where judges live in fear. I spoke to judges in Guatemala a few years ago. And there are, sadly, countries around the world where there is a great deal of judicial corruption. I helped train judges in Moldova, and that they came out of the Soviet system, and the judicial system was corrupt. Fortunately, we live in a country where almost every judge is a hardworking, honest person. Are we perfect? No. Do we make mistakes? No. That's why that we there are appeals. But by and large, the judges in our country are hardworking public citizens who do their best every day to fairly apply the facts and follow the law. And no one should be subjected to threats against themselves, their family, their staff. It's wrong. It's un-American. And my personal view, anyone who engages in that, particularly if that person is a public official or a candidate, should be condemned, and in my opinion, draws a question as to their legitimacy.
And as Judge Calabrese said, you've been on the bench for quite some time now, since 1998. Can you talk over the arc of your career about the change when it comes to the climate and perception in your eyes of the judicial system, including any threats made against judges, lawyers, and jurors?
Sadly, I think in recent years, the climate has gotten worse. It now seems to be okay to voice any hostile, angry, threatening thought that comes into one's head. It's okay to voice it. I certainly wasn't raised that way. That's the climate we live in, and it affects all of us, and I'm dismayed by it. It's harder to be a judge now than it was when I came on in 98. You know, we signed up for it, but we didn't sign up to be physically threatened or to worry about our family's safety.
Judge Calabrese, last year you sentenced a Cleveland man to 3 years of probation, 100 hours of community service, for threatening to kill former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. In your decision, you stated, quote, "This case shows the troubling state of civic discourse in our country. People will inevitably disagree with each other on important matters. Disagreements cannot spill over to violence or threats of violence, particularly to public officials." What do you make of this moment where you are seeing more instances of this harassment and violence targeted at public officials?
Well, I do think I agree with what my colleague had to say. I think it is increasing in its frequency and its acceptance as a tactic. What I have seen is that it is unfortunately become very much a tactic. It's well-funded. It's done by people at times who are well-positioned, who are public officials, and it does extend to not just judges and justices, but in many cases to their spouses and family members as well. And I agree that should all be condemned. It should be out of bounds. I think one of the things we have to appreciate, and I've come to see there's a critical lack of civics education in this country, and I think we need to understand what it is judges and the judicial system do as opposed to what Congress or legislatures and executives do. What goes on, in my view, in the judiciary writ large is not politics by other means. Mm-hmm. And our founders and the experience through our history really underscore the importance and necessity for judicial independence to make sure that our separation of powers and other rights that we enjoy under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the laws of the United States are enjoyed by all citizens.
If I could jump in.
Please do, Judge Polster.
I mean, this is Law Day, May 1st, and I think that's why we're on. And everyone in our country should appreciate what we have and what a blessing it is. I mean, if you travel around the world, a majority of countries in the world do not have a free and fair judiciary. I mean, in this country, if you have a dispute with anyone, an individual, a corporation, a government, you can go into court and have your case fairly decided under the law and the facts by an impartial judge. We take that for granted here. Most people in the world don't have that. And we've had it for almost 250 years. We fought to get it. We fought to keep it. I certainly don't want to lose it. But we'll only keep that if we have good men and women who are willing to be served. And this state, state judges are all elected to run for office. Federal judges are appointed. But men and women of character, quality, integrity who are willing to serve and perform that. But, you know, we talk about the rule of law. I mean, it's as strong as the men and women who were sworn to uphold it and willing to serve. But, again, most places in the world don't have it.
Do you think, Judge Calabrese, that there is, you know, you talk about civics instruction and Judge Polster is talking about the context of American justice versus other places in the world where that's not a given. Do you think there are ways to counter this current climate in which maybe your perception of the justice system is allowed to be swayed so strongly by politicians, by rhetoric? Is there a way to counter that?
Well, I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. I think there are a few things that can be done. I think it's worth pointing out that it's long been known, and I started by referencing the ethical rules that we as judges operate under. So we are not really in a position to defend ourselves in many ways. So we depend on others, other institutional actors, whether it's political leaders, lawyers, bar associations, and the like. And one of the things I've seen in recent years is, unfortunately, in my opinion, bar associations willing to take sides in the debates and become political actors as opposed to even-handedly denouncing attacks from whatever direction they come.
And Judge Calabrese, I want to stay with you with this question. Some legal experts have said there is a danger in the rhetoric that someone out there who's on the internet watching may be mentally unstable and may see the complaints on judges or their families as a call to action. Do you have a concern about that and kind of the amplifying effect the internet has and how messages might be inferred by someone as some sort of violent call to action?
Well, look, none of us are above criticism, and I think as my colleague says, you can agree with my decisions, disagree with them. I think what distinguishes the judiciary is that unlike the political branches, we typically give reasoned decisions rooted in the law. Sometimes you get that, you know, more political motivations and statements and the like, and that's appropriate for the other branches. But all the judiciary has, as Hamilton said in Federalist 78, is reason. We don't have force or will. We just have reason. So that's ultimately what we rely on. So you need that robust public discourse about what we're doing. So we're not above criticism in that regard. I think as a society, there's some very difficult issues we're all struggling with in terms of how we deal with the internet and social media and so forth. And we'll come to terms with all of that over time, I'm sure.
Judge Polster, do you think there is any legitimacy in the public having complaints or concerns about bias by judges and how the legal system handles this?
Well, we have, Jenny, we have a system. If a lawyer or a litigant feels that a judge in his or her case has any sort of bias or partiality, they can file a motion to recuse. It's an established procedure, and the judge looks at that carefully, and if the judge agrees, thinks there's a concern, he or she recuses, and another judge takes the case. And if the judge disagrees and denies the motion, well, that can be appealed generally. So there are established ways. If a lawyer or a litigant has any concern about a judge in a particular case, but to loosely throw around, say, so-and-so's crooked or corrupt or biased, that's wrong. If you've got a specific allegation based on facts, there's a way to make it, and you do it. So we have an established system for that. And I think it works very well.
Judge Calabrese?
One of the things I'll jump in and add on that, I agree with all of that, of course, but I think a lot of times today, lawyers and litigants are quick when they're on the losing end of a decision to immediately attack the legitimacy of the institution that rendered that decision. And I think in most cases, that's probably almost all cases, overwhelmingly irresponsible. And I think lawyers in particular should know better than that, because there is a sense in which lawyers have a duty and a special privilege that we afford them to use their position to educate the broader community in moments like that. And we certainly have had any number of cases over time that are very high profile and divisive in our society, and lawyers have done that. And I will say from where I sit in my experience, I have seen far less of that in recent years than in our historical perspective. So I think there are opportunities, to your earlier question, for us as a society and for the legal profession to do better.
I am speaking with two judges currently about the state of respect and honor for the judicial system, and even concerns about any sort of criticisms, harassment, or attacks on judges. I'm talking to the Honorable Dan Polster and the Honorable J. Philip Calabrese, both working for the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Ohio. I'm curious, you know, in this day and age where you're talking about lawyers acting quickly, people appealing to the court of public opinion as opposed to the courtroom, how difficult is it for you as judges to essentially block out the noise and stay adherent to what you say, reason, rule of law? I'll ask you that, Judge Polster.
Well, it's a good question. I've had to do that over the last 6+ years in my opioid multi-district litigation, which has been handled in the public eye from the beginning. I think that's one of the advantages of having life tenure. I know that, you know, whatever decision I make, some people will like it, some people won't. Maybe everyone will think I'm wrong. Each of us has to do the best to focus on each case and determine the facts fairly and apply the law and make the best decision we can. And again, and then go to the next case. And if we get reversed, you know, we fix the issue the Court of Appeals says we need to fix. And as Judge Calabrese said, we're not politicians, all right? When you walk into a courtroom anywhere in this country, you're not seeing a politician up there. Even if someone was elected, all right, his job is not, you know, he's not a politician in that case. His job and her job is to apply determine the facts fairly and apply the law and make the best decision that judge possibly can and be fair to the lawyers and the parties. And I think overwhelmingly judges do in this country.
I will say, I think a lot of times there's a tendency in public debate and in conversations like this as well to focus on the hard cases or the controversial ones. And the reality is, I haven't looked at the statistics lately, but I did a couple of years ago. Americans are quite litigious. We have a lot of lawsuits across the country, even just in federal court. Again, I forget the numbers. I know it's thousands of lawsuits filed across the country in federal courts every year. The overwhelming majority of those are resolved at the district court level, where Judge Polster and I serve, without an appeal, which shows some
well over 90%.
Yeah, shows some degree of acceptance by the parties of those decisions.
Right.
And when cases are appealed, the overwhelming majority of appeals are affirmed by 3-judge panels unanimously, showing that there's general agreement on what the rule of law requires. And so by definition, when we start getting into some of these conversations, we're talking about cases that are outliers.
Let's take a call from listener Jim calling in from Cleveland this morning. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. First off, I'd like to say I do not envy judges and elected officials during this time. It sounds very perilous. It sounds like the safety issues have clearly gone up, and that's very worrying, especially given what the judge was talking about in Guatemala and some other countries. I also agree that civics has to be more emphasized in schools. I also think that one of the reasons that we're in this situation is our elected officials in Columbus and in D.C. are not doing their job. So the courts have had to fill that void to varying degrees of approval. That all said, the idea that judges are not political was shown to be false, has been shown to be false by the Fifth Circuit Court's recent rulings, by the Supreme Court's recent rulings, not recent, even for the last decade. So I think we really do need to do away with this whole idea. I mean, I live here in Cuyahoga County. You see judges looking to get elected, and they say the Democratic-endorsed, Republican-endorsed. The idea that judges are not elected, or they're not political, I think we need to do away with that. I don't think anyone's fooled anymore. And also, I would have to say that this starts from the top down. And the Supreme Court, we have to say, has been shown to be illegitimate at this point. You have two justices, Alito and Thomas, that are completely conflicted and should have recused themselves dozens of times over and never did. And that trickles down.
Okay,
and
Jim, I do appreciate your point. I think it's well taken. And I will turn this towards our judges. I mean, you know, so that's a perception out there. And I do think it's not a minority perception when you look at some of the decisions made by the court system. So what would be your response to that, Judge Calabrese?
Well, I completely disagree that the Supreme Court or any other court at this point has become an illegitimate institution. And to me, it shows that the attacks work. I think if the attacks on the judiciary and judicial independence did not work, you would not see them continue. But I think opinions like that are evidence that it does, and they're effective. And that's unfortunate. And that's why I do think it's incumbent on Judge Polster and I and others, lawyers, bar associations, and all citizens to come together and to recognize the legitimacy of these institutions, because they're strong, they're bigger than us. They will long outlast both of us, and we need them to serve their constitutional functions. I could say more. But
yeah, I would just add on that. I appreciate your comments. The difference between a judge and a politician, even if the judge is elected in a partisan election, when that judge decides a particular case, that judge is not making a political decision. That judge is looking at that case. If the judge has to determine the facts, you have an evidentiary hearing, you hear from the witnesses, you make credibility findings, you make the facts. You're applying the law, you look for binding authority in your circuit or Supreme Court or, if it's state, the same thing. So you're making a legal decision, whether you were elected or appointed. And so that's the difference between a judge and a politician. With respect to the Supreme Court, I personally think the Supreme Court has created some of their own problems by exempting themselves from some of the rules that apply to the rest of us. And I think that has created an image problem with the Supreme Court, candidly, for those justices. But again, I believe they do the same thing when they have a case. They're not making a political decision. You may agree with it, you may disagree with it, but they're trying to interpret the Constitution and the laws according to principles.
And finally, Judge Calabrese, you know, building on what Judge Polster just said, how, again, you said you don't have answers to how to rectify the public perception problem, but how do you continue to share awareness when it comes to perception of the court, and that people from all striads of the community will get treated fairly?
Well, I personally think it's incumbent upon all of us to do what Judge Polster and I are doing today, is to get out and talk to people, to meet them where they're at. That involves some education about what we do and how we go about our jobs. There's tremendous confusion, I find, about what judges do and the different court systems. We do have a complex system, so to some degree that's understandable. But it also involves listening to people like your caller and engaging with them. I do, although I disagree with the ultimate legitimacy point, I do take some of his earlier issues and concerns I think he's right about. But I think just being part of the community and not up in some ivory tower where we're not engaging with our fellow citizens is a start.
That's a great point. And I have found this conversation enlightening.
And if I could add 30
please,
seconds.
Please do.
I think
please
it's,
do. Sorry,
it's
Judge.
Incumbent on all of us, particularly lawyers and judges. We were trained to be able to disagree agreeably. And that is a critically important ability to have in a democracy. And I think we are starting to lose that. We were all raised that way by our parents. You know, when we were kicking or biting or screaming, our parents would say, use your words, all right? That's what they meant. So we all have the ability to do it, and we all need to do it a heck of a lot better if we want to keep our society together.
Judge Dan Polster and Judge J. Philip Calabrese with the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Ohio. It's been a pleasure, and I thank you both for your time this morning.
Thank you very much. Privilege to be on.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and on the other end, we're going to talk about East Tech High School, home of Jesse Owens and other Olympic champions, and how they're restarting their track team after the COVID pandemic. I'm Jenny Hamill. This is The Sound of Ideas. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks for being with us this hour. We are less than 90 days away from the start of the 2024 Summer Olympics in Paris. The United States has long found Olympic greatness in track and field, and Cleveland's East Tech High School can lay claim to two of the biggest track and field legends of all time, Jesse Owens and Harrison Dillard. Both won four medals each at the Olympics. Owens won his medals in 1936 in Berlin, and along the way short-circuited Adolf Hitler's plans to use the Games as a showcase for Aryan dominance. Dillard's greatness came in 1948 and 1952 after being inspired by Owens. Now, East Tech High School has leaned into that history to bring back its track team. The COVID pandemic knocked it out in 2020 when sports district-wide were canceled. Joining me now to talk about the return of the East Tech High School track team and the lasting legacy of Jesse Owens and Harrison Dillard and their inspiration for a new generation, I'm joined in studio by Michael Hardaway. He's the coach of the boys track team at East Tech. Welcome to you.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Leroy Carter, campus coordinator at East Tech and the former athletic director.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Okay.
And you just told me, but I hope I don't botch it. Zyke Harris, the current student athlete at East Tech. It's great to have all of you in studio.
Thank you,
I always love a full house, and I can't wait to talk about this. If you have a question for any of our guests, like to join in the conversation, call 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Leroy, we're going to talk a bit about history. Let's talk about Jesse Owens and what made him such a legendary athlete on the field, and how does his legacy, do you think, extend to 2024, to today?
Being a former athlete of East Tech High School, hearing all of the great things about Jesse Owens growing up just inspired me to want to be an athlete like Jesse Owens. But his legacy still stands because you still have athletes across the world, across the country, that looks up to Jesse Owens as a role model. You know, you had Usain Bolt that just won gold medals in like the last three Olympics. You know, his main idol was Jesse Owens. You have some of the state champions that came out of the state of Ohio, looked up at Jesse Owens as one of the great athletes that everybody wanted to be a role model after. So his legacy to me will always stand as long as track and field is around.
And Leroy, you know, he was so great on field, but he endured so much off field, including even racism here at home.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did a lot of great things. He was a part of a lot of boards, the Olympic Committee board, the high school athletic conference committee. So he did a lot for just Cleveland alone that a lot of people don't know about. So Olympic year, it's a shame that they only talk about it during Olympic time of all of the things that he did. But he did things throughout his whole life.
Mm-hmm. All right, Coach Hardaway, it seems then almost unthinkable that East Tech wouldn't have a track team given the history. Talk about how the team kind of dissolved during COVID and how about your efforts to bring it back.
Well, it was just tough on the boys' side. You know, Leroy was just telling me like last year, just the numbers weren't there. You know, we've been trying to recover after COVID. Our girls, you know, he's been able to keep that program afloat. But, you know, we struggled with the boys a little bit. So that was one thing.
You say numbers, you mean the number of student athletes?
Athletes on the boys' track team. So, you know, when I was hired as the boys' football coach, you know, I wanted to take on the track assignment. And we've been, you know, getting better interest. I think we got about 13 or 14 boys involved on the track team right now.
And how much do you think about Jesse Owens just kind of as a part of the spirit of East Tech and the legacy that he leaves?
Every day. Zakir probably would tell you that I spoke on the legacy of Jesse Owens way back during football season. It's very important to me. Every day that I walk the halls of East Tech, I think about him. But I stand in awe that he really walked, maybe not that same building, but he walked the halls of East Tech High School. And it's just an honor to even be the head coach of East Tech Track with just the legacy of Jesse Owens and Harrison Dillard. So it's something that I take real serious.
Zyke, you're on the team. So how is it being a part of this comeback? And does the Olympic legacy and the stories of Jesse Owens and Harrison Dillard, do they play in your mind?
It do. It's really amazing because it's just something new to me. And that I just gives me more time to hang around my friends and just get better get better at running and things like that.
So how much do you like running and running fast?
I like it very much. Like, I like it real bad. Like, when I'm running, everything is just clear. And it's a lot more easier for me to just cope with anything.
I love that. Clears your mind. I think a lot of runners would agree with that. Are there specific track meets or, you know, categories that you're doing?
Yeah, I do the 100 meter, the 200, the 4x1, the 4x2.
And Coach Hardaway, how's Zyke looking? Is he getting faster and faster?
He's getting better every week. You know, we just stay on top of him, you know, to become a better student athlete, just always bettering himself every day. So, you know, him being a freshman, you know, we hope to have him for the next 4 years. And we expect some great things from him, both on the academic side and both athletically. So, you know, continuing to get better as a young man every day.
And Zyke, I got to ask, you know, obviously athletics is super important. You say you get to hang out with your friends and clear your mind and be a part of something important. And I would assume the structure is good, too. How does it help you in other aspects of your life, participating in sports, you know, when you're not at school or with your academics?
Well, it keeps me out the street doing bad things or any other type of ungood activity. And me doing track, it just make me want to tell all my other friends come do track instead of just being in the streets and acting crazy and wild.
You know, and I understand, Leroy, that I was reading some history on Jesse Owens. I mean, he had it tough growing up, and they were coming out of the Great Depression and all of those things. And really, for Jesse Owens, it seemed like finding track and field was an escape and was a chance at a whole new world. And I read that ultimately he was the only one who actually stuck it out in high school because his brothers and sisters had to quit school to work to help their family. So really, it was a saving grace for him.
Yes. And I just recently found out that he didn't even receive a scholarship for Ohio State. He had to work still, you know, to pay for his education at Ohio State. He came from, a hard come up from, you know, coming from Alabama with, I think he was one of nine, I think, brothers and sisters. So he had a lot to bring to the family. You know, his brothers worked at the steel mill, his dad, and they gave him a chance to run. He
when he didn't run, he was working. Mm-hmm. So the coach, he also says his middle school coach is who he credited for his career.
That's right.
Because he was the one that let Jesse Owens work and then either practice before or after work or school or whatever. So he gives him a lot of credit for him being the person that he is.
It's amazing when one person sees promise in another and cultivates that, you know, what can happen. If anyone has a story they want to share about their thoughts on Jesse Owens and the Olympic greats or East Tech High, call in 866-578-0903 or you can email us at soi@ideastream.org. Now, Coach, I'd love to know, what's your hope for the team? And you know, you're just kind of getting started. You've got time to cultivate. But what's your hope for what you guys can achieve in the short term?
Well, you know, some of our goals are we want to be city champions again. You know, we look up on the wall every day, and we look at the history of East Tech track. It's a very storied program, so the pressure is on.
Mm-hmm.
Our expectation is with this group in the next – 1 to 2 years is that, you know, we're qualifying for the state meet in Columbus. We understand there's steps that we have to take to get there. We need to win our city and be strong in it. We need to win our district and win our regional. And then we can make it to Columbus. So we understand that it's a work in progress. We're looking for all of the guys to get better this summer. If they're not doing work or football, we're expecting them to run with some different track programs in the area.
And Zyke, how are you preparing for all of this? I mean, what's your running regimen look like?
I do my 35-minute jog around track field, anything. So I just try to keep myself fit and ready for anything.
And are you working in the gym? I mean, is there a weights component to any of this?
Yes.
Yes.
And how is your eating regimen? Are you eating healthy?
No.
So that's something that you know, that's something that we're talking to our boys about, and we're trying to get some better nutritional options for them on a daily. So that's something that, you know, we're working to bring to them as well. So
sure.
That's something with young people talking about dieting, it can get tough sometimes. So we just trying to work on the hydration process right now.
Oh, good for you. And that protein, those veggies.
Yes.
But I know a Big Mac will just fade right off you. So they're like, I'm going to McDonald's. Let's take a call from Ishmael in Akron. Ishmael, good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. How are you?
We're doing well. What's your thought?
Hey, my name is Ishmael El-Amin, and I am a film director and producer, and I just produced an up-and-coming ESPN 30 for 30 film on Akron's own Butch Reynolds.
Nice.
And it's airing on ESPN on June 11th. But I just wanted to say, because I just love this conversation, because if you watch the film, Butch talked about, you know, till to this day, you know, Jesse Owens being the greatest Olympic athlete of all time. And it's the reason why Butch went to Ohio State in the first place. And I think that, you know, Jesse just doesn't get his due in regards of the legacy that he left in track and field. But I just wanted to commend you guys for this conversation.
Well, Ishmael,
Thank you, Ishmael.
Yeah, appreciate that call. And Leroy, you're nodding your head. Do you think he doesn't get his due?
Not enough credit at all. And that's expiring, because we actually have Sports Legends of Cleveland now. And Butch Reynolds was actually there at the first induction, and he gave the speech for Harrison Dillard, a former Olympian of East Tech also. So Butch said in his speech that Jesse Owens and Harrison Dillard was the two that really inspired him to become the great athlete that he is. I actually ran against Butch Reynolds in college.
No.
Yes, yes.
How
yes,
did you do?
Yes. I'm not going to say. Him and his brother.
Where's your 30 for 30?
Yes, him and his brother, we ran a 4x4 against them in Arizona. So
that's incredible.
Great, great, great athlete. You know, Butch is another one of those ones that, you know, inspired, you know, my age group to be great runners. Another Olympian, you know, out of the state of Ohio.
Now you carry it forward. So, Zyke, we're running out of time, but do you have aspirations for greatness on the field?
Yes, I do. Like, I just dream of it, and I just feel like I got to go make that happen.
And you work hard to do it.
Definitely.
So, Coach, we've got about 30 seconds left, but it must be exciting to work with these young individuals. And you don't know, you know, you might have them for 4 years, but you shape kind of what they're going to be like for the rest of their lives.
It's my inspiration. They inspire me as much as I inspire them. It's the reason why, you know, when things get tough, I just keep going. They motivate me through a lot of things. I want to see them go on and do well, even if it's not in the realm of sports. We want to set these young men up for, and these young women in our program up for success. So that's our main thing. We want to bring out the best in them. As a student athlete, we want to see them continue to grow as people.
Coach Michael Hardaway, Zaikee Harris, and Leroy Carter of East Tech High School, my thanks to all of you.
Thank
Great
you
to see you this morning.
Thank you.
As we mentioned in the conversation, Harrison Dillard also had his track and field start at East Tech. After being inspired by Jesse Owens, Dillard went on to win gold in 1948 and 52. He's the only person to ever win gold medals in the 100-meter dash and the 110-meter hurdles. Former Sound of Ideas host and producer Rick Jackson got a chance to sit down and talk to Dillard back in 2018, 1 year before he passed away. We should note, as Rick Jackson was preparing to retire last year, we asked him about his favorite interview. And without missing a beat, Rick said, talking to Harrison Dillard. That gives me chills. Well, here's their conversation from back in 2018.
I was there because I'd had a dream that began when I was 13 years old.
Harrison Dillard grew up in Cleveland, like many young boys of the day, idolizing two larger-than-life African-American sports stars, boxer Joe Louis and Olympian Jesse Owens.
Jesse Owens, the Buckeye Bullet, stepped into his dust and rolled as he streaked down the red cinder path in the 100-meter dash to win in the phenomenal time of 10 2/5 seconds, breaking all existing world records.
But Owens was more than a star on screen. He was from the neighborhood, from East Tech, the same high school Dillard would attend. Dillard set state records in high school. Later, he won the NCAA and AAU 120-yard and 220-yard hurdles in both 1946 and 1947, matching world records at the time. And he became the only Olympic athlete in history to win golds in both the sprints and hurdles. But you know that, or you should. So let's skip to that moment 70 years ago, standing on a podium in London and hearing the Star-Spangled Banner.
I remember vividly when we were presented the medal, the gold medal, and I stood on that stand, and they played the national anthem, and the flag was slowly raised, and I said, wow. I said, I'm standing just where Jesse stood, what, a dozen years before I had that dream.
I read where you said the hair on the back of your neck stood up as you listened to the American anthem played.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
There's nothing like it. And I guess having been a soldier not too many years before, and especially the fact that I was a grunt, you know, I was in 92nd Infantry, I was a foot soldier. So all those things just kind of came rushing back as I stood there and watched that flag go up.
Talk to me about being in the war. You saw combat, and in many cases, though, you went to places where white soldiers could do one thing, but your battalion, black soldiers, couldn't. That had to be painful. You're serving the country and you can't be on it.
There was one incident that comes to mind. This was in Italy where we served, and it was almost the end of the war. I think the war ended about 3 weeks later, and went through this little mountain village. And prior to that, any place that we went, people would come out and welcome us. But this little particular mountain village, when we went through, all the windows were covered over, the drapes were pulled, and we didn't see the people. So we wondered. A couple of guys could speak a little Italian, and they asked them, what, che passa, you know, and they said, well, they'd been told that the Nero soldati, the black soldiers, that they would mistreat the women and the children. So who told you that? I said, the American soldiers told us that. And at the same time, we're fighting right next to each other. That's the, you know, the unusual part of it.
That battalion of black soldiers he referenced was the famed 92nd Infantry Division, sometimes called the Buffalo Soldiers, an all-black unit often credited with helping turn the tide in Italy. Because U.S. armed forces were segregated, men of the 92nd Infantry were the only black unit in Europe of more than 900,000 African Americans who served in World War II. Dillard is one of the last remaining heroes of that group.
You discount the idea of being a hero, but because of doing the things you did when you did them, you realize why people look at you as an American hero.
Well, yeah, when you stop, and in retrospect, I guess, when you can kind of put it in context and think of the things that happened and what some people view as a hero, then it makes a little more sense then. But when you're going through it, boy, all you want to do is get it over with and get out of there.
That humility is evident by what you see in his home. Prominent are the Olympic torches he later carried to support others, one he ran with in Cleveland as the flame went to Los Angeles in 1984, the other he carried commemorating the Salt Lake City Games in 2002. There are proclamations from mayors, and there are a few trophies, including his favorite.
A few years ago, I got voted into the IAAF, that's the International Hall of Fame Track and Field, which means all time, no matter who. And this is my favorite.
What you don't see displayed is the gold. We had to nearly beg to see his Olympic medals from 66 and 70 years ago. His most noted achievements, they were boxed and put away.
A little different than nowadays. Now they're on colorful ribbons and they put them on your neck.
Does it surprise you that people still make as much a fuss over what you did some 70 years later?
In many ways it does, but at the same time, it's the Olympic Games, and I guess because of their significance, it has a lot of interest for many people.
Does it still, in a way, seem like yesterday to you when you were running?
Not quite. I wish I could compress 70 years into yesterday, but no, I'm well aware of the great length of time.
A change that he sees as having put emphasis on things greater than just running fast, jumping high, as the newspaper clippings and photos attest that he did so much better than so many others.
What do you think of today's athletes that are, taking a stand, and whether it's kneeling during the anthem or whether it's speaking out about police brutality? What do you think of the way that today's athletes are not just athletes?
I commend them. I think they're doing something that's necessary, and in time, I think when enough people, when a majority of our citizenship realizes what these guys are doing, that they'll be looked upon as heroes too.
As he is looked up to now. Baldwin Wallace University still hosts the Harrison Dillard Indoor City Track Championships. His statue stands on the campus where he achieved his first national notoriety before and after his military service. His life of service to others continued. Following graduation, he eventually found his way to the Cleveland schools, where he was a vital part of the administration for 27 years and loved the work. Still loves track and field, too.
What do you think of today's athletes? Tyson Gay, Usain Bolt, the guys who are running and setting times and speeds that you never could have imagined.
Well, I sometimes wonder what would happen if I could compete under the same conditions, if I could have, how much better I could have been. Now, obviously, I could have been better. We all could have been better. But with the advances in medicine and knowledge and training techniques, there was just a natural improvement. And the human race gets better as time goes. And these guys are evidence of it. They're proof, living proof.
You still like to sit and watch track meets?
I still watch. I still watch. And I said, wow, that guy can run.
That was former IdeaStream host and producer Rick Jackson in conversation with Olympic gold medalist Harrison Dillard back in 2018. We'll have a link to that conversation and video piece on today's website. And IdeaStream's Gabe Kramer has a terrific feature on the return of the East Tech High School track team. You can hear that this afternoon on All Things Considered. Now, to get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter now, X, at Sound of Ideas. You can follow me at JennyHamill_ or on Instagram at JennyHamillIdeaStream. Tomorrow on the Sound of Ideas, we'll discuss the pro-Palestinian protests that have sprung up on colleges and university campuses around the country. And we'll hear the response to those protests with local and national reporters. And we'll talk to an eyewitness of the May 4th shootings at Kent State ahead of that tragic event's 54th anniversary this weekend. Also, the next Sound of Ideas community tour is happening next Thursday, May 9th at 6 p.m. at the Cleveland History Center. We'll be talking about the wealth and power here in Northeast Ohio. Who holds power? How did they obtain it? And can you come to power without wealth? Again, that's next Thursday at 6 p.m. at the Cleveland History Center. Find out more and register at ideastream.org/community tour. Now, if you missed any portion of the program, you can find us online or you can stream the Sound of Ideas podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll speak with you again tomorrow.